This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
We need help. They're not doing nothing. They're not telling us nothing. They're not doing nothing.
How would you react in the face of an urban catastrophe? Today we'll hear about fleeing New Orleans, not just Katrina and the flood, but an outbreak of racial violence that tore apart the city a century ago.
So he told my mother, this is no place for us to raise our children. We got to get out of here.
We're talking about how cities all over the world cope with disaster. My guest is Simon Winchester, whose new book examines the earthquake that decimated San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century.
America had the confidence to put cities where it jolly well wants to put cities.
And I'll also talk to National Book Award nominee Joan Didion about her year of magical thinking.
I was realizing I had actually been slightly crazy for a period of some months.
That's coming up next in Studio 360, right after this.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. 2005 will go down as a year of epic, terrible disasters. It began with the South Asian tsunami, through the catastrophic earthquake in Pakistan, several hurricanes along the way, including, of course, Katrina. It has all been like a global car wreck. And we, those of us lucky enough not to get caught in it, are like rubberneckers. We cruise by, staring and sympathizing from a safe distance on the internet and cable news channels. It was a very different age when the great 1906 earthquake shook California. Newspaper accounts were all my grandparents had to chronicle the quake and fires that leveled San Francisco. There's a great new book just out about that disaster. It's called A Crack in the Edge of the World, and it's by Simon Winchester. Winchester is a geologist as well as a journalist, and he investigates disasters from their deepest cores, literally, through their various cultural aftermaths. Simon Winchester, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello, thank you.
So what drew you to the big one in San Francisco, 1906?
Well, the most obvious thing is the anniversary that we're coming up to in April 2006. But once I looked at it a bit more closely, it seemed that it represented a turning point in the way that humankind looks at natural catastrophes. Because up to that point, essentially, we blamed all of these gigantic catastrophes on God. It was the work of an angry deity. A classic example would be the Lisbon earthquake of 1755, where the prevailing view was that this was the work of an angry deity and he needed to be placated. And the way to do that was to round up all the local heretics and burn them. And that's what happened. And it has to be said, there hasn't been an earthquake in Lisbon since, and it probably had some effect. San Francisco, though, things changed. They didn't change in an enormous way, in that there was a very significant religious reaction. And one can say, with a fair degree of accuracy, that the aftermath of San Francisco led to the birth of the Pentecostalist church in America.
Really?
It really did. I mean, there was this man, I think his name was Thomas Parham, who was a Texan preacher preaching in Azusa Street in Los Angeles, came out on the Sunday, the 15th of April, saying there will be a sign from God. And this was reported in, I believe, the Los Angeles Times the following morning. And 3 days later, there was an enormous titanic event. And there was no doubt that the city that had been destroyed was the most sinful city in all of America. And so the following week, thousands of people turned up at this little ramshackle church to hear a preacher with a somewhat smug smile on his face say, "There, essentially, I told you so." And with that, within, according to the historians of the charismatic movement in the United States, this church then spread like wildfire. And the Pentecostal church is the bedrock, really, of fundamentalist Christianity in America today, has given us the luminaries like Pat Robertson and Jimmy Swaggart and Tammy Faye Baker. But the important thing, and sorry this to get to the end of this rather long point, is that in 1906, for the first time, there was a rationalist approach. Why did this happen? It clearly wasn't the work of God. I mean, that was mumbo-jumbo. But it was the work of some curious force deep down in the earth. Let's unleash our scientists rather than our clerics. Let's find out what happened. And that was the beginning of the whole science of seismology.
What changed as a result of this new empirical idea of how cities ought to be built, or this city?
It could have been built in a grand style because there was a plan waiting in the wings by Daniel Burnham, who was essentially the creator of contemporary Washington, D.C. and post-fire Chicago. And he had prepared a plan for this new great imperial city. And it was full of boulevards and fountains, and it would have looked the part.
Well, maybe I'm not sure looking like Washington rather than present-day San Francisco would necessarily be so much better, would it?
You're absolutely right nowadays. But in the view of the people in 1906, and this was the time when America had imperial interests across the western side of the Pacific, and they regarded the primacy of San Francisco as unparalleled. I mean, they didn't think that Los Angeles was actually going to take over to be the major city on the West Coast, and they wanted something that looked absolutely splendid. Anyway, Burnham's plan was not adopted because the mercantile interests of San Francisco said, let's just get on with rebuilding it. And once the California Earthquake Commission had determined that this was in a part of the world likely to be afflicted by more earthquakes, the building codes changed and things like brick buildings disappeared and everything was built of reinforced concrete and flexibility in tall buildings. And the codes just increased year by year by year to where they're some of the toughest in the country today.
Only 30 years after the quake, MGM made its big epic film called San Francisco with Clark Gable playing a saloon keeper turned politician. Let's hear a little bit of that.
I'm no politician. I didn't ask for this. But now that I'm in it, I won't stop until I get some decent fire laws for our people down on the coast.
Is that more or less how it happened?
It is, really. I mean, there was a tremendous upswell from the people who were tired of getting burned out. In 1906, the earthquake came out of a clear blue sky. The fire that followed it, there was a sort of, we've seen this before kind of mentality. But the difference was that it could not be fought.
We haven't any water. It's the only way we have of stopping the fire.
I mean, the fire chief, Dennis Sullivan, had been killed in the earthquake and all the water mains had been severed. So it was an unfightable fire. And the only way you could deal with it was to dynamite fire breaks, which they did, and wait for the rain, which happened on the following Saturday. Since then, and of course in the early days, there were no paid fire departments. It was all volunteers. And then there were paid fire departments, and they competed with one another, and they slashed each other's hoses and so forth because they got paid by the number of fires they put out. So it was sort of typical San Francisco. It was a rambunctious, devil-may-care kind of city, and yes, after pressure from people like the Clark Gable kind of people, there was a degree of professionalism. But, of course, one of the things that was a consequence of the earthquake was that San Francisco lost its primacy as the major city in California. And Los Angeles, one can argue that the film industry and so forth would have eventually made Los Angeles a very big city. But there was one simple fact that San Francisco was on a major and very dangerous fault line, and Los Angeles was not. And there is the ever-present, the knowledge that Oakland and Berkeley and Richmond are going to be hit and hit hard when the fault that runs under them, the Hayward Fault, pops. And there's a 62% probability that it will with a magnitude 6.5 or above in the next 20 years. So things are not looking terribly good for the north of California.
My guest is the author and geologist, Simon Winchester. We're talking about how cities recover from disasters or fail to recover. It'll be a long time before we can completely evaluate how New Orleans is going to come back. Thousands of people displaced by Hurricane Katrina are now leaving their temporary housing and starting to figure out the rest of their lives, including how they'll return to their city and if they'll return at all. Its musicians are among them. From Mardi Gras to Jazz Fest to the brass band Second Lines after funerals, musicians are central to New Orleans, to its soul, probably more than in any other American city. But rebuilding the musical scene is going to be a lot tougher than just fixing a broken levee. So I decided to call up my old friend Lee Harris, better known as Little Queenie. She has been making music in New Orleans for 30 years, and I asked her what she plans on doing now.
Well, I can't believe I'm... every time I say it, I stumble. I bought a house in North Carolina.
But why have you decided to leave?
Well, because it's hot down there, for one thing.
Well, it's no hotter than it was before.
Well, it was bugging me before this. I have wished for a long time to take everything that is in my heart, which has always been informed by the drinking water in New Orleans, by the rhythm of the river, by the rhythm of my roots, and, you know, everything in my soul, everything I do is informed by having grown up there. And, you know, music started for me when I was about 18 months old. And it started right there, and I want to take it everywhere. That's all I ever wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
And I was in Austin recently at a benefit for New Orleans, and somebody out in the crowd was saying, gee, they were talking about two A-team jazz players who had gone to Memphis from New Orleans, and had decided to stay for like at least 6 months, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were already getting gigs all over the place. And this genius Austin guy who'd been drinking all day long said, "Hey, man, this is going to change American music forever." It's like, you know, yep.
Well, it's interesting that he said American music, because obviously it sounds like it's probably not so good for New Orleans music if all those guys are going and you're going. But if all of these New Orleanians, as you say, A-list people are showing up elsewhere, that might seed scenes in those other places, no?
I think it's very, very exciting. All I ever wanted to do when I got into this was to make all kinds of music with all kinds of musicians all over the world. But, you know, this maybe is the catapult to bring me into that wider circle that I've been calling to for so long.
Beautifully said. Leah Harris, thank you very much. Great talking with you.
Great talking with you, as always.
You can find out more about Lil Queenie at Studio360.org. Coming up, a riot 100 years ago in New Orleans that planted the seeds of jazz all over the rest of the country. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by Nonesuch Records, presenting In the Heart of the Moon, an instrumental duet album by Malian guitarist Ali Farka Touré and Toumani Diabaté on African harp, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We're talking today about how cities recover after enormous disasters. We just heard how New Orleans artists are picking up the pieces and rebuilding their lives after Katrina. But 100 years ago, a very unnatural disaster had just as profound an impact on that city's culture. One reason New Orleans has had such an incredible music scene is that all the way back at the turn of the 20th century, it was one of the few places in America where people of different races could play and live and work side by side. That delicate balance blew up in 1900. That was the summer that the city's native-born whites, ethnic immigrants, blacks, and Creoles found themselves in the middle of a race riot that changed American music forever. Alan Lipke has the story.
They had a song out on Robert Shaw's. Like many of us bad men that always had some kind of a song and somebody originated on them.
The speaker, Jelly Roll Morton, was a New Orleans Creole born Ferdinand de Lamothe. He was 10 or 15 years old when police arrested the black bad man who inspired the song.
But this song was squashed very easily due to the fact that it was a trouble breeder. And I found it was best for me to forget it in order to go along with the world on the peaceful side.
Jelly Roll told the story to musicologist Alan Lomax in 1938 during a marathon recording session just released in an 8-CD set on Rounder Records. The incident happened on the sweltering evening of Monday, July 23rd, 1900. just 35 years after the end of slavery, and just 4 years after the U.S. Supreme Court had endorsed segregation when it upheld the conviction of a young Creole named Omer Plessy for challenging New Orleans' separate railroad car law. Historian Bruce Boyd Rayburn takes up the tale.
Robert Charles was, quote, loitering in front of a white family residence, attempting to visit a girlfriend who apparently was home but was not answering the door. She lived in a slave quarters in the little house in the rear. This was reason enough for him to be confronted by the policeman, who basically said, "What are you doing here?"
That night, Robert Charles and the arresting officer shot and wounded each other. Then Charles ran. 4 hours later, at 3 o'clock in the morning, the fugitive shot and killed two more policemen.
The riots broke out after the newspapers were filled with the killing of the policemen.
White mobs roamed the city looking for people of color to murder in retribution for what Robert Charles had done.
Any place you've seen a white man, seen a colored man, there was a fight. Or a colored man, seen a white man, there was a fight.
More than 60 years later, musician Louis Capard explained to jazz historian William Russell how he and his father escaped the mobs.
My father, he could pass around the street, and it wouldn't worry him, because my father was a Creole. You couldn't tell him from French, you couldn't tell him from Italian, and they couldn't tell him from who's who.
It was Friday, July 27, before word spread that Robert Charles had killed two more policemen and holed up in a small wooden house on a crowded downtown block. Police besieging Charles's hideout were joined by 10 or 20,000 civilian, mostly armed, mostly white men. Maurice Gilbert and others recorded their memories more than 70 years later for the Friends of the Cabildo Oral History Project.
The whole city went out to see if they couldn't get him. The police and everybody else. People broke into stores that sold guns and ammunition.
Justine Lubat.
Everybody was trying to catch him, but he kept on shooting and shooting, and it's like they had a hard time getting him.
And every time he would raise his rifle, when a policeman was in sight, there'd be a policeman dead.
My grandfather was shot in the groin. I can remember my mother walking up and down on that front porch. She was so worried trying to find news from everybody, you know.
Thousands of shots were fired during a six-hour siege. The killer hit a score of policemen and civilians before they smoked him out of his second-floor hideout.
When they finally got him and killed him, they said that they laid him in a wagon and dragged the streets, the old cobblestone streets, with his head hitting the cobblestones. Yeah, I remember that.
Like so many race riots, the Robert Charles riot terrorized colored communities as the press carried its white supremacist message nationwide. But it had an important effect on world culture as well, which went far beyond the song Jelly Roll Forgot.
At that time, we had a lot of great blue players around, right in the section where the Robert Charles riot began.
It occurred in a part of the city that produced a number of notable jazz men.
Jelly Roll Morton claimed to be the inventor of jazz. But as Bruce Boyd Rayburn points out, he was just one of the New Orleans musicians who had lived and worked the multicultural musical exchange which conceived the music.
Larry Shields, for example, who was the white clarinetist with the first jazz band to record, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, lived next door to the man who is recognized as the first leader of a jazz band in New Orleans, an African-American clarinetist named Charles Bolden, better known as Buddy Bolden. And it was possible for those individuals to work with white musicians and actually perform publicly.
But then came the riot, says Professor Rayburn, who's the director of the Hogan Jazz Archives at Tulane University.
So people who had performed as musicians in New Orleans, being attracted to the blues and jazz at exactly this time, had to witness this white rampage against people of color. Big Eye Louie Nelson DeLille, for example, his father was murdered.
Riot survivor Louis Capard sings You Made Me What I Am Today with Big Eye Louie Nelson DeLille's band.
I think every musician was affected by that, including Bolden and Jelly Roll Morton. I mean, Jelly hits the road in 1907, and Louis Tio talks about his father, Lorenzo Tio.
My father decided that he seen the change, how the people begin to segregate. So he told my mother, this is no place for us to raise our children. We got to get out of here.
Musicians such as Johnny and Baby Dodds, bandleader Charles Elgar, and later Louis Armstrong scattered to safer and more lucrative places like Chicago soon after the Robert Charles riot. Professor of Medicine Robert Schneidau.
Oh, they were leaving New Orleans on every train they could get out of here. That's why so many of them left and went north.
Perhaps it's too much to say that diaspora served world culture. But unquestionably, the Robert Charles riot helped push jazz from its New Orleans womb, the city rose above the disaster, and the music went on. For Studio 360, I'm Alan Lipkin.
And I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the author Simon Winchester. Simon, that's almost exactly the era, the same era as your book on San Francisco. Did the San Francisco earthquake and fires in 1906 trigger any kind of artistic exodus there?
Yes, they did. The artistic community, they scattered like rats leaving a sinking ship. It was awful. I mean, the places like, you know, I mean, Jack London and all the people that we knew and loved from pre-1906, San Francisco went off to Carmel by the Sea and Sausalito and went far and wide, and a diaspora of San Francisco writers. They remained, generally speaking, in California. And it really wasn't until the 1950s and the Beat Generation and Howell and Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti and all those people that San Francisco got back on its artistic track. And so for 40 years, there was something of a cultural wilderness caused directly, I think, by the earthquake.
Well, it's interesting to think about alternate histories. In New Orleans' case, if this riot and the resulting enforcement of a new segregation hadn't happened, you wonder if jazz in its embryonic state might have remained a kind of particular New Orleans music and not had its spores affecting the rest of the musical culture.
Well, and I was thinking as I was listening to it how other cities, which for sort of internal reasons have exploded or imploded, and where the artistic community spreads its wings. I mean, Belfast is a good example. I mean, I was there for 3 years in the 1960s and 70s when that city was being devastated by internal schisms between the nationalists and the loyalists. And the artistic community there fled and went principally to London. And so you see people in London to this day who have abandoned Belfast and Northern Ireland and choose to live in calmer climes. Now they may be going back, not least because of the tax incentives, of course, in Ireland to promote writing. So it happens in all sorts of places.
As a historian of disaster and having looked at what happens when cities are destroyed and either are rebuilt or not, do you have a prescription for what they ought to do in New Orleans now?
If there is a pan-American feeling that New Orleans ought to be revived as a city, then clearly it can be built within a system of protective levees that will allow, you know, the mercantile interests to come back, and then market forces will bring it back. But I'm just not sure that it should happen. Clearly, there should be a major city and a major port at the mouth of the Mississippi River. I mean, that is crucially important. But is that the most sensible location for it? If those grain elevators were moved upstream 20 miles and if the channel was dredged, the commercial city could move north to a place that wasn't going to be knocked back time and time again. Would the New Orleans that we know and love follow, or will it become a diaspora and go to Austin and Houston and New
York? We'll have a little beautiful French Quarter Garden District Museum of a New Orleans that was, I guess.
I think that is the most likely outcome. I know it's a heresy to say so, but fast forward 100, 200 years and look at a map of the future of America, and I don't think New Orleans, as currently located, will be on it.
It seems to me, and Katrina really shows this, that Americans, and we may or may not be extreme in this, are so often and so profoundly in denial about the potential disasters that await us.
I absolutely think so, and I think there's something to say about, look at the experience of Europe and Asia. The cities that exist have, generally speaking, been there for thousands of years because they're built in seismically stable parts of the world and not afflicted by extremes of weather. And so London, Paris, Berlin, Moscow, Peking. On the other hand, these same countries are littered with the ruins of cities that were built where they shouldn't have been built. Pompeii, Herculaneum, Petra. But America doesn't have any ruins. In its 250 years of existence, it's had the, if you like, the hubris, the confidence to put cities where it jolly well wants to put cities. And it's somewhat eccentric to put places like Phoenix and Tucson and even Las Vegas. I mean, there's no water there. There is no great tradition in the rest of the world of building cities in the middle of deserts. So I think they and New Orleans will eventually turn into ruins. And of course, that old adage about humankind exists on this planet subject to geological consent, which may be withdrawn at any time, is something that we should all bear in mind, I think. I mean, I had this marvelous exchange recently. I was talking about the upcoming eruption of the supervolcano under Yellowstone National Park, which is going to happen one day.
And really?
Totally. I mean, it's this. The recent research they've done on the floor of the Yellowstone Lake and River shows that the bed of these two entities are rising and falling and rising and falling as if this great magma body, which everyone knows exists under Yellowstone, is breathing. If you're of a sort of romantic disposition, you can think of this gigantic monster underneath. Sooner or later, it will erupt. I mean, there's no doubt at all about that. And when it does erupt, there's equally no doubt that it will devastate the northwest of the United States in its entirety. I mean, the northwest of the United States will be finished.
Beyond Wyoming.
Oh, well beyond.
From Nebraska to Oregon.
Puget Sound, yeah. And I said this to the group
of people. So anytime? I mean, should I make my vacation plans?
No, and this is the point, because I said, but don't worry. I mean, this is, in geological terms, not immediate, although fairly soon, about 250,000 years, by which time, I said to this audience, the entire human race will be extinct. And this woman in the front row raised her hand and said, what? She said, what? Even Americans will be extinct? So denial exists in all sorts of ways.
Simon Winchester is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. 10 years ago this month, the Dayton Accords ended the war that ravaged and broke apart Yugoslavia. It was a genocidal war, all the more stunning for taking place in the backyard of civilized Europe. And the contrast between civilization and brutality was especially apparent in Sarajevo, the most cosmopolitan city in the Balkans. Sarajevo was a place where you could peacefully attend Orthodox churches, synagogues, and mosques. And there was a thriving art scene and theater scene and beautiful public buildings. And everything had been spruced up for the 1984 Winter Olympics. Then, starting in 1992, the city endured nearly 4 years of constant shelling and sniping by Serbian gunners. Today, much of the physical damage has been repaired. But as Dave Johns found out, the city's cultural life faces a much longer road to recovery.
Joe Sacco draws comic strips about real people in war zones, and he went to Sarajevo in 1995 to gather material. He started hanging around bars and cafes, and he soon met Shoba, a big, loud, garrulous guy who seemed to know everybody. Shoba was a painter, a guitarist in a rock and roll band, a partier, and a volunteer soldier in the Bosnian army, a sort of romantic artist warrior figure.
He was kind of the man about town. I mean, his job was planting landmines and finding enemy landmines. But, you know, he really thought of himself as an artist. So he was just an intriguing person and full of wartime philosophy and spirit and depression.
Shoba became one of the subjects of Joe Sacco's new book, War's End. His real name is Neboj Šerić, and he had been a student at Sarajevo's Academy of Fine Arts. When war broke out, his life went off the rails. Shoba hid away in his basement for months, drank too much, and tried to block out the absurd war outside.
You know, I was barely, getting out, and actually a couple of my mates just robbed the supermarket because, you know, there was total anarchy. There was no police, no traffic lights, no schools, nothing, you know. Yeah, and there was the only thing what was valuable was suddenly just food and a booze. That's all you need, and water and some basics. I remember the guys who have brand new BMWs who sold them for like 6 packages of feta cheese, you know. Because what you gonna do with your brand new car without gasoline in the middle of a war zone? What you gonna do with it?
Finally, Shoba came out of his basement and enlisted in the Bosnian army. On days off, he went back to his studio.
Before the war, I was just making landscapes, portraits, and like nice art, fine arts, you know. I didn't really want to think about something deeper than that. But in a war, first of all, you don't have material to make paintings or anything because everything is suddenly, you know, inaccessible. So you have to start experimenting. So I find myself making like sculptures out of, you know, shrapnels and exploded bombs and like pierced helmet. I was just reacting to my, you know, environment, which was terrible.
Virtually every building in Sarajevo was damaged, many completely destroyed. The historic National Library burned to the ground. Sarajevo was being demolished, but its art scene was thriving. At night, Shoba would dodge sniper bullets to get to underground clubs. They would host rock shows powered by generators.
Art in Sarajevo during the war mattered to the point of life and death.
That's Bill Carter, an American who found himself drawn to Sarajevo during the siege.
Whether it was an opening of a painter, you know, you had to run through Sniper's Alley to get to the opening. So, you know, what if you died on the way to the opening? I think that it just really was a testimony to the idea that you just have to keep on living.
Soon, outsiders began to wake up to the dissonance of the barbaric siege of one of Europe's great cities. The late Susan Sontag visited in 1993 and staged Samuel Beckett's play, Waiting for Godot. She compared the conflict to the Spanish Civil War, which gave us Picasso's Guernica. U2 wrote a song called Miss Sarajevo and later played a concert.
Is there a time for keeping the distance? The time to turn your eyes away. Is there a time?
Late in the war, a group of filmmakers organized the first Sarajevo Film Festival as a reminder to the world that Sarajevans were starved for culture as well as food. During the feature film, Pulp Fiction, the boom of explosions outside syncopated with the crackle of gunfire on screen. By the time of the ceasefire, some 12,000 had been killed, and nearly half Sarajevo's people were gone. A photographer named Nihad Pushia, or Nino, was one of them, and he captured other refugees arriving in Berlin.
That's some months after the beginning of the war, and there were thousands of people flying out of the country, and that this is the moments when they are arriving in Germany. And you see the all these faces, you see all this trauma. But in this moment, they are very powerful for me because you see like your neighbors, you know, and they are leaving their homes.
His photo is part of a show called Sarajevo Self-Portrait, A View from the Inside. It's showing in New York right now to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the Dayton Peace Accords. Nino himself was a refugee, escaping Sarajevo by pretending to be a foreign journalist. He still visits frequently, and though he says life there today is not easy, he has hope for it.
It's true that there is no money, there is no jobs, but it's kind of cool to come to live now there because you don't know what is going to be. And that's the reason because it's always attractive for new artists. It's like in Berlin, you know, they open the wall and then the whole world came there. And this is also happening in Sarajevo, but in smaller numbers.
Shoba stayed in Sarajevo for a time. Late in the war, he'd gotten an invitation to work in Milan, all expenses paid, but turned it down. He claimed he didn't want to be just another refugee from Bosnia. But now he's resettled in New York and married to Leslie Fratkin, who curated Sarajevo Self-Portrait. Shoba's not as sanguine as Nino about the city's prospects.
This is like some kind of moving circus, like, okay, it's not Bosnia right now, now it's Chechnya. Okay, it's not Chechnya. Okay, let's we all move to Iraq now, you know. As long as the attention is on that spot, the thing is going to flourish. You know, the thing is going to be great for that community.
Shoba's career has gone well since the war. He's shown his work internationally. Joe Sacco, the cartoon journalist, suggests that Shoba's departure and Sarajevo's return to obscurity were probably inevitable.
I mean, Shoba once told me he was worried that at some point, Sarajevo would end up being a backwater again, and it did. I mean, the truth is, I mean, Sarajevo was kind of the center of the world for a lot of people's lives in the West because it was Sarajevo under the siege, and this whole idea of a multicultural society, a very civilized society being under siege was a very compelling sort of story. Afterwards, Sarajevo became Sarajevo, a small little town in the Balkans.
For Studio 360, I'm Dave Johns.
And I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I'm talking about cities coping with all kinds of disasters with the author Simon Winchester. Simon, you've written about Sarajevo. Were you struck during the war by that sense of the cultural life going on against all odds?
Yes, but I must say I thought it was somewhat artificial, as one of the people said in that interview. The world was looking inwards at this amazing multicultural city that had been conveniently forgotten for decades. It didn't produce a great deal of art or poetry or anything until suddenly the world discovered it and said, gosh, what an amazing experiment. It's going wrong at the moment, but we must, you know, bring orchestras and jazz bands and you too. But then when the tragedy ends, when the peacekeepers and the bureaucrats, I mean, Sarajevo today is a city just filled with European bureaucrats and rebuilding and getting the sort of the governments of the city and Bosnia generally up and running again. And that has a deadening effect.
Are there other examples since the earthquake in San Francisco in 1906 of a real and important and vibrant city facing catastrophe and recovering, rebuilding as a vibrant, important city?
Outside the United States, I mean, one has to say Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, both of those cities are today incredibly impressive. I mean,
Tokyo, for that matter.
Well, I was going to say Berlin. I mean, there was a city. I mean, the devastation after the Russians moved in 1945 was near total. Now that city, one of the most glittering and culturally interesting cities on the planet. So, I mean, that's a classic example of a city that's rebuilt itself. But a city which is has lost its heart, if you like, because of some terrible act of violence like World War II, hasn't necessarily lost its soul. And I think Berlin never lost its soul, and that's the important thing.
Simon Winchester, thanks very much for joining us in Studio 360.
Thank you.
Simon Winchester is the author of many books, including The Professor and the Madman and A Crack in the Edge of the World. You can find out more about him at studio360.org. Coming up, the novelist and essayist Joan Didion finds her worst fears realized and writes through the grief.
A good part of my of the experience for me had been trying to avoid thinking about the past, and so it was necessary to mention the past in order to say what I was avoiding.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by None Such Records, presenting In the Heart of the Moon, an instrumental duet album by Malian guitarist Ali Farka Touré and Toumani Diabaté on African harp, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Luc Dubois is a musician, a computer programmer, and an assistant professor at Columbia University. He spent the last couple of years developing a technique called time-lapse phonography that produces a kind of condensed collage of a whole lot of music. But better to listen to him and some of his work. The subject of his latest sonic artwork is Billboard's pop music chart, 42 years of number one hits compressed into a half-hour piece he calls simply Billboard.
So if we take a song like from 1966, if we take Diana Ross and the Supremes, Keep Me Hanging On. Set me free, why don't you pay? I play it through a computer program I've written. It just looks at the spectrum. It looks at the frequencies and the components and the sound and just averages it over time, much as you would average the stock market or any other thing. And then eventually you just end up with this long sustained chord. For every week a song is at number one, you get 1 second of sound. So if you spend 10 weeks at the top of the charts, your song lasts 10 seconds. And I string them all together, just chronologically. you know, I didn't write this music, and I didn't curate this music. It was curated by, you know, young Americans of the last 50 years who bought records and called into the radio. This was curated by other people, millions of other people. I'm just figuring out an algorithm, a way to sort of present it for people to listen to. But the piece lasts about 37 minutes, through which you hear from 1958 to 2000. What you do is you get kind of a snapshot of the piece, and you can sing the song over it and tell that it's in the right key. And you can tell things about how the record was produced. Over time, these averages get noisier and noisier because drums, which are basically noise, get louder and louder in record mixing since the 50s. The key areas change over time. So in the 50s and 60s, you get a lot of songs still that are in brass keys. They're in keys like B flat and E flat. And by the time you get into the 80s and 90s, almost everything's in the key of C and G and D and A, sort of common guitar keys. And some really interesting things happen, like in the sort of high disco period, everything stabilizes to the key of D for some reason, all those Bee Gees songs. There were a few moments like that where it sort of would level out and something about the sound would really change. Hip-hop tunes becoming number ones. The only real pitched tone becomes things like the bass line. And the rest of it is just this kind of veneer of noise from the rapping and the drums. If you ask someone who was sort of alive and listening to the radio at the time, what would be their most important song, maybe from any given year, what they say and what the chart says probably aren't the same thing. So a good one is 1967, right? The Beatles song, All You Need Is Love, only spent 1 week at number one. The big hit that year was probably To Sir With Love by Lulu, I would bet. 5 weeks at number one. Are we going to get to the point in our culture where people have a hard time listening to a 2.5 minute pop song without channel surfing? I see people do this on their iPods all the time. They'll listen to songs only through the first chorus, and then they'll switch to another song. They'll jump around. And I wonder if we're going to get to the point where it's unreasonable to ask somebody's attention for 3 minutes just listening to music. And then, what do? Well, you give it to them in 1 second chunks.
That was the musician and programmer Luc Dubois. To find out more about him, visit our website, studio360.org. Our piece was produced by Trent Wolbe. Joan Didion, the novelist and essayist, had her life turned completely upside down one night. Her husband of 40 years, the novelist John Gregory Dunne, suddenly died. They were sitting down to dinner one night after visiting their only child in the hospital. That child, their daughter Quintana, had fallen into a coma after treatment for pneumonia and septic shock. Then this past August, Quintana passed away as well. So within a year and a half, Joan Didion lost the two most important people in her life. And yet, in the midst of all that, she wrote a book about her horrible, disorienting losses. That book is called The Year of Magical Thinking, and it's now a bestseller and a nominee for the National Book Awards. The winners of those awards will be announced this week. Joan Didion, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
How soon after those experiences did you decide, I'm going to spend X number of months writing about this?
What happened immediately after was, well, not immediately. It took Quintana about a month to get out, to become conscious and get out of the hospital. And then we had a funeral. And then a few days after the funeral, Quintana and her husband flew to Los Angeles, and she, because she was on a blood thinner, had a bleed into her brain and had to have immediate neurosurgery at UCLA. So I went out the next day and was there for 5 weeks with her and then brought her back here to the Rusk Institute. So I didn't have a thought in my head except Quintana. And in mid-July, I realized that I had promised to do the convention. So this was the summer of 2004.
A year ago.
Yeah. And then I was left with nothing at all to do. I was under contract, actually, to do a book about Kobe Bryant. But in the interim, John died, and Quintana was sick, and it became the last thing on my mind. And also, around the same time, I was realizing I had actually been slightly crazy for a period of some months. And then suddenly I found myself coming up with an idea about how to structure it, and then I realized that I could actually write a book.
Did you have a sense of, I want to help others in something like my circumstance to cope?
I didn't consciously think that, but I thought it might be of interest to others because it's such a universal experience, and yet when I was looking for guidelines myself, I found so little that was helpful.
Well, you write about your attempt to look at what the experts and the shrinks have said. What was your impression of the take?
Well, a couple of anthropologists I read had written at length, Jeffrey Gorer and someone else, about the changes in attitudes toward death in the Western world since the beginning of the 20th century. But at some point after that, we medicalized death. We put it in the hospital, and around the same time, we stopped being able to look it in the eye. We stopped knowing what to do or say. You would be amazed the number of people who tell you to think of, who urge you to think of the wonderful times you had. This is apparently unaware that the past tense is a kind of downer to the person who had the wonderful times.
Well, and as the book for the reader, as the readers will discover, goes back and forth with you between you dealing with the here and now of your grief, of your, as you say, going a little crazy, and memories of your life with John and with Quintana as well. Did you set out thinking that it was going to be that kind of flashback memoir?
No, I did not have an intention of that at all. What became clear was that a good part of the experience for me had been trying to avoid thinking about the past, trying to avoid any physical location or person who might remind me of the past. And so it was necessary to mention the past in order to say what I was avoiding.
All those good times you were supposed to be thinking about.
Yes, exactly.
You say you went a little, you discovered or realized that you were going a little crazy, and you call the book The Year of Magical Thinking. Is that ironic, or do you really think you were engaged in magical thinking?
Magical thinking. It was in the sense that anthropologists use it. I mean, it was if I did such and such, if I invoked the right rituals, if I did the right thing at the funeral, he would come back. Now that's like saying that if you sacrifice the Virgin, the crops will come in. The other level on which it was magical thinking is, you know how children think magically? They think that
there's Santa, for instance.
There's Santa, and also if I hadn't been bad, Mother and Daddy would not be getting a divorce right now.
Right.
And so the magical thinking goes to the amount of guilt that almost everybody feels.
So it's self-punishing as
yes.
well as
yes.
superstitious. If I put his shoes here, he'll,
right.
he'll wear them again.
Yeah.
Over so much of your work over the last 40-odd years, there is a kind of exquisite sense of imminent disaster, menace, doom lurking around, hovering. And as I was reading this book, I had the sense that, okay, that has finally been realized.
That shoe dropped, yeah. Someone suggested to me that it would eventually perhaps be kind of liberating in that the worst had
happened. This is as bad as it gets.
This is everything I was afraid of had happened. That might turn out to be true.
Did, in the conventional sense of closure, I know an idea that you despise, did writing the book feel therapeutic?
Sometimes it did. Sometimes I would go over the pages at night and I would just sit there and cry. Not at the pages, but just because the material enabled me, made accessible to me a way that I'd felt about, that I hadn't allowed. So in that sense, yes.
You and John were each other's, not only collaborators on films, certainly, but each other's first editors for 40-odd years. What was it like to write a book and not have him to show it to?
It was, it made me mad. The first couple of things I wrote after he died, which were pieces, I felt desperately the need not to finish them because he wasn't there to read them. I would have no way of knowing whether it was time to turn them in or not. But then I kind of got past that. So that wasn't why I wanted him to read this. I wanted him to read it because it was something that happened that I wanted him to know about.
Joan Didion, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks very much for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Arun Roth,
David Krasnow,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Derek John,
Sarah Lilly,
Amol Mathre,
Caitlin Lindsay,
Katie Gradowski, Chris
Roos. And our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Alan Lipke's piece on the riot that spread jazz around America was made possible by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. To find out more, you can visit www.racewithhistory.org.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You know about the Munchkins, the flying monkeys, and the witches, but the Land of Oz is stranger than you ever imagined. We'll discover why this American icon inspires countless filmmakers, musicians, and novelists, and serves as a metaphor for practically everything. The Wizard of Oz, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.